From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On our panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Richard Latendresse, White House correspondent for TVA, the French-Canadian television network. Richard is joining us for the first time as a panellist. And here are the issues. Catalans, who voted in their millions to declare independence from Spain, suffered a reality check this week. France and other European nations expressed opposition to a breakaway country of Catalonia, while dozens of large companies moved their legal headquarters out of the region. President Donald Trump is poised to announce that the Iran nuclear deal brokered by his predecessor Barack Obama is against America's national interests, putting the pact's future in doubt. Mr. Trump also seems to edge closer to pulling out of the NAFTA free trade pact with Canada and Mexico. In Congress, private grumbling among leading Republicans burst into the open when Bob Corker, chairman of a powerful committee, accused Mr. Trump of risking World War III by treating the presidency like a TV reality show. And an American woman, her Canadian husband, and their three young children were freed from 5 years of captivity by the Haqqani extremist group in Afghanistan. Donald Trump said their release showed the world now respects America. So, let's start with Catalonia, the region in the northeast of Spain, with about 7.5 million people. They had a vote, Richard, which was overwhelmingly for leaving, but it was not legally authorized by the central government. What was the consequence of that this week when the government of Catalonia kind of reported on the lesson they draw from that vote to leave?
Well, it's very interesting the way actually they are caught into this framework where there's the legal status in Spain and their own will on their side. And there's this, the referendum, not even 50% of the electorate took part of it. So by extension, it's hard to give full legitimacy to the process. So they were caught in a situation where the central government could come up with two strong arguments saying the law was not respected, the way the legal, the constitutional framework was built did not favor this, and besides, the popular vote didn't go this way either. And it's interesting, David, if you allow me, because we had it, you know, remember in Canada, we had this these referendums in Quebec, and Canada adopted a clear, as much as it was challenged in Quebec for a while, we have a clear system now that says if there's a referendum, if there's a vote, and if it's a positive vote, it has to go this way. And that was not as clear in Catalonia.
And Linda, so Richard has explained very well that legally, the Catalan case for saying we have proved legally that we get to leave now, that legal case is very weak. But the political case is much more hard to predict. I mean, you saw extraordinary scenes during this referendum of Spanish national police literally beating people to prevent them from voting. So that clearly was a political disaster for the Spanish central government. But then when the president of the breakaway sort of Catalan region spoke to Parliament, he didn't say, that's it, we're off. He said, we're suspending this mandate. Why did he take a step back? What might have given him pause for thought on the sort of political front?
Well, I think, as you suggested, the you know, the departure of business from the Catalonia region really is serious and actually central to this independence movement. I mean, the initial grievance is it's over cultural rights, you know, things like the right to speak in the native Catalonian language in the Spanish parliament. They don't have that right. But it's also economic. Catalonia sees itself as the economic engine of Spain. Spain is having a longstanding economic crisis. Catalonia feels as if it's supporting the rest of the country, wants to enjoy that economic autonomy. But with most of the world against this kind of breakaway movement, it really does give them pause. And I think they saw that it could have a serious negative economic downside.
So, Richard, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because if you look at clearly your own country, Canada, Quebec, the French-speaking region, if you look at my own country, mm-hmm. Britain, with Scotland, which occasionally wants to break away, you have a dynamic where sometimes it's the smaller, poorer region that's willing to kind of take a big risk to have, you know, home rule. In Catalonia's case, you had this place that felt richer, that was paying more of the taxes, that felt like it would have this very easy independence where perhaps the rest of the Europeans would welcome them as a new European country and it'd be rather rich and it would break away from Spain. That didn't happen, did it? Other European governments very quickly told the Catalans that they would not be welcomed into the European family. What was going on there?
It was very clear from the European Union members that actually they're a group, they're a club of state, and they're part of this union together in one piece. And unless I believe Catalonia would have been able to show, and that's why you're so right in underlining the fact that the pictures of Spanish police fighting the independentists on the street were so bad for this Spanish state. Besides this, Catalonia cannot claim, even if at some level they can feel a little bit not as able to be themselves as much as they'd like to, they cannot claim that they're oppressed by the Spanish state. On the contrary, they're a dynamic state. They're a dynamic people within the state. They have got more and more autonomy in the last decades. So not only the European Union was clear in saying, no, we're not going to recognize you. President Trump, when he received that White House, Prime Minister Rajoy from Spain, said also that he preferred a united Spain. So finally, this future state of Catalonia would have been on its own as dynamic as it can be.
It's a fascinating story, and we'll have to come back to it in future weeks as these very tense talks get underway. Let's look at a story that has been dominating a lot of the kind of foreign policy discussion here in Washington, D.C. Every 90 days, President Trump has to say whether he believes that the Iran nuclear weapons deal is in the interest of the United States. This is something that the American Congress imposed on Barack Obama, Linda. He doesn't like having to say every 90 days that this deal should carry on because he spent a lot of time on the campaign trail saying it was an embarrassment and the worst deal ever signed. Now, we're expecting the president to say, actually, that he's staying in the deal. So how does he explain to his supporters that he's staying in this deal that he has said is the worst ever? What's he expected to do later today in Washington?
He will decline to certify the deal. He'll decline to certify that Iran is in compliance, although all his advisors and the intelligence community has told him that they actually are in compliance. But what he will also say is that this deal is not in the U.S. national interest, and that he then wants Congress in the next 60 days to sort of lay down markers for compliance. And
he could have said to Congress, okay, I'm handing it to you, but you can slap on as many sanctions as you like,
right,
and blow up the deal. Or he could have said to Congress, okay, Congress, actually, I'm done here. Just do nothing. We'll just carry on. He's choosing a middle path.
That's right.
He's going to say, Congress, help me fix this deal. So maybe mm-hmm. leave that international deal on the table.
Right.
Leave it in place, partly because the other signatories, like the Europeans, have no interest in revisiting that deal.
Right.
But his idea is, his officials have talked about a second deal that would lie alongside mm-hmm. the Iran deal and would try and fix some important things. Richard, what are the important things that this administration thinks really need fixing in that Iran deal?
The administration felt that this deal should have helped contain the Iranian influence in the region, not only stop its nuclear program, but also slow down, if not stop, its ballistic work, its work on missiles, and also contain its growing work in the region support for groups in Yemen, of course, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Bahrain. So the administration actually sees more in this deal than there was, even if there's a line that underlines the fact that they I don't have the exact wording, but it says that it expects that Iran will be part of the international community in respecting the laws and the borders of the other countries and respect the other countries. But in the end, the deal itself was a way to stop Iran on its path to a nuclear weapon. The administration wants to see this deal as a way to contain and slow down the influence, the growing influence of Iran in the region. And that's what the deal is not doing. But they expect this other option they're seeing would do this, actually.
So, Linda, as Richard says, essentially, the argument from Trump and his team is that this deal was a missed opportunity. It missed a chance to, as Richard says, to really enforce the UN sanctions on things like building ballistic missiles that can reach, you know, far beyond Iran. Is there any sense that other countries that signed the original nuclear deal, so France, Germany, Britain, Russia, China, are they interested in kind of reopening the whole thing and revisiting that broader question of Iranian bad behavior?
Absolutely not. Now, the United States is out on a limb on this, or Donald Trump, I should say, because his advisors also want to stick with this. So what we've wound up with is sort of a compromise, not decertify, but also not say that this deal is in the national interest. And so we have this kind of middle ground. And it's, I think, for Trump's advisors, for particularly his very military dominated team, they're also looking at North Korea and seeing, you know, if the U.S. really got out of the Iran nuclear deal, why would North Korea go along with any kind of deal on denuclearization if the moment we elect a new president, you know, it's off?
And Richard, just very briefly before we go to the break in sort of 30 seconds, Congress now has the control that it always says it wants over policy, you know, consult Congress, let Congress decide. Actually, in their heart of hearts, do lots of members of Congress want to be responsible for the Iran deal? Are they going to sort of take advantage of this, or are they actually going to try and pass the buck back?
I feel they're going to try to pass the buck back. Every expert they had in front of them, the committee that worked on the issue, James Mattis himself,
the defense secretary,
said the deal is working. So why would they play with this? Well, actually, everybody says, no, it's doing what we want it to do.
Thank you. Well, we'll have more in just a minute. This is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist, along with our panelists, Linda Feldman at the Christian Science Monitor and Richard Latendresse with the French-Canadian TV network TVA. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Listen to it and tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page. Now, Richard, you're the big French-Canadian commercial news station guy inside the White House. You had a busy week because the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, was in the Oval Office. I think you were there watching him with President Trump. Clearly, two countries which are absolutely, you know, doomed to have to get on. They are giant neighbours. The NAFTA trade deal, it sounds a bit boring, but actually it's a really important trade pact between Canada, Mexico, and America, and a kind of symbol of whether Donald Trump really, really does want to change the way that trade works and become more of a protectionist. It's been kind of a bit of a sort of roller coaster the last few months, hasn't it? You know, maybe actually it was all talk, maybe he really wasn't going to destroy these trade deals. What's the mood in Canada now in terms of thinking that Donald Trump might be serious about really reshaping the way that free trade works?
The mood, David, is slowly to consider the second option, which is actually then make a separate deal with the U.S. This was not in the air, I would say, 3 months ago.
So tear up NAFTA and have just a Canadian-American deal.
At first, especially because, as you were underlining, the hints we were getting from the White House were all over the place, but mainly that the problem was with Mexico. The Americans had a problem with Mexico, not so much with Canada. Mm-hmm. Some tweak here and there. That's what the president said. So for a long time, Canadians felt that we will negotiate the problems we have, but in the end, we're going to keep this NAFTA agreement. But slowly, now it sounds more. It looks, the president wants a deal on this, or he wants to do something on this, obviously, and he's playing his cards in such a way that he hints at tearing it apart and really negotiate something else. So Canadians slowly are considering the options of, well, okay, let's do a deal between ourselves and forget about Mexico.
One last question on Canadian public opinion before I ask Linda about how this is going down in Washington. So President Trump gets elected as the America First president. He's going to put America's interests first, American workers first. How much room for maneuver does your Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, have? Is he under pressure in Canada to make sure that Canadian interests are also represented? I mean, how much ground can he give?
He cannot give that much because we have a very clear system in such a way that protects, for instance, dairy producers and poultry producers, and they are important in our economy, and they're influential, and they're respected. The other thing, David, is that the Prime Minister, and he comes forward with this constantly, underlines the fact that hundreds of thousands of American jobs are linked to the Canadian economy. And he has the support of several governors at that level, saying, no, let's not touch this side of the agreement because, obviously, we will suffer probably as much in our states from tearing up the agreement than they would in Canada.
So you think that this sense, Linda, that maybe this was all talk, that Donald Trump was, you know, rhetorically willing to tear things up. Within that, Linda, tell us about his own party, sort of leaders of the Republican Party in Congress who traditionally have been quite keen on things like free trade. When they watch this, are they confident that this is a president who knows what he's doing? What do we know about the mood of his own leaders and colleagues in Congress?
Well, that perhaps takes us to our next topic, which is sort of the blow-up this week with the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker. Trump went after him on Twitter, mocking him for deciding not to run for re-election. And Corker came back with an interview in the New York Times that was absolutely stunning, calling Trump, calling the White House an adult daycare center, and that apparently with Trump's tweeting habits, the minder had the day off or some such comment. I think members of Congress are watching Trump and his Twitter feed the way the rest of us are, which is just with our jaws on the floor that he says such intemperate things on such high-stakes issues.
And Bob Corker, just to tell listeners, you know, in the Washington system, the senator who is in charge of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he's a really powerful guy. He has a lot of oversight over things like the Iran deal, where the sanctions go back. And beyond the kind of the bizarre personal insults that you talk about, and I think at one point Donald Trump mocked the fact that Bob Corker's not very tall, there is a serious point, isn't there, that Bob Corker was saying that some of these presidential tweets had actually made life much, much harder for important diplomatic negotiations. And is there a sense that Bob Corker was speaking for more than himself, that he was reflecting the views of, say, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State? I mean, what's going on when Bob Corker launches this kind of personal war of words?
I think Bob Corker is not alone. You know, people are saying, well, nobody's backing Bob Corker, but there really would be no point. I mean, Bob Corker is a respected, even-keeled member of the Senate who actually tried to work with Donald Trump. Bob Corker is
was even considered very briefly for his vice president.
For vice president and for Secretary of State. You know, respected member of the Senate, and he finally just gave up. And I think this is really is reflective of views, widely held views on the Hill, but Corker is kind of taking the hit for it.
So, Richard, I think all of us, the three of us here, Bob Corker was saying in public things that we have heard in private for months. I mean, particularly on the Senate side, senators are really sick of the president on a personal level. They don't like him. They don't like the way he bullies people. They don't like the way he seems to be disloyal to senators who have taken risks for him. What are the kind of real political consequences? Do you expect a kind of rebellion now where the Republicans turn on Donald Trump, or do they still are they still frightened of him and his voters?
I don't expect the rebellion to be obvious yet. I think Bob Corker is the face of the reaction to Donald Trump. I think my impression, David, and what I hear and what I see is that the president is just going to have more and more problems to have his agenda move forward. He's going to face more and more senators for all sorts of reasons not in favor of considering this, supporting a new nominee. And that's the problem with this attitude that he has and this way of not only not supporting Corker, but humiliating him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not something that's going to help his agenda, whatever the topic.
You make a really excellent point by bringing up his agenda, because, Linda, there's a kind of vicious cycle at work here, isn't there, which is by attacking senators when he really does not have a big majority to work with,
right.
He makes it harder to get his agenda through, the things Republicans really want to do. But then, actually, one of the reasons that these fights are getting so vicious mm-hmm. is that behind the scenes, a lot of senators, they're losing faith generally that they're going to get anything done. I mean, if they were holding their tongues and not attacking Donald Trump because mm-hmm. they thought they would get to do tax reform and cut taxes on businesses and things Republicans have always wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
is there now a growing sense that actually maybe between now and, say, the next congressional elections in November 2018,
mm-hmm.
there's a growing sense that maybe they'll get almost nothing done?
That's entirely possible. And we also have the specter of Donald Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, has declared war on the Republican Party, the mainstream party, and has promised to put up sort of Trump-like populist nationalists against all the senators who are up for re-election. So it's, I think, really going downhill.
Well, I'd like to end on something of a positive note. We've spent a lot of time looking at the problems in Washington, but over in a tough bit of the world, the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, we've had, you know, what looks like a good news story. We've had a very unusual rescue by the Pakistani military of an American woman and her Canadian husband and their three young children, Richard. Tell us the story of this rescue. Still early days, there'll be other details, but what do we know?
What we know is that this couple, so she was pregnant, she's American, he's Canadian, Josh Boyle, and they were hiking in Afghanistan, which is actually interesting these days. She was pregnant at that time. They were kidnapped by Al-Qaeda network, militants in the area linked to the Taliban. And she had her baby and two more kids. So three kids there, two boys and a girl, while they were in captivity for 5 years. We now understand that they were held on the Pakistani side of the border. The point is that for 5 years, we're trying to find them. And during the last days, with information coming from the American intelligence community, the Pakistani military spotted the a van carrying the family, intervened, fired at the tires, and in the end, freed the family, freed the five people, and they're alive and well, the five of them.
And Linda, very briefly, in the Washington end, Donald Trump announced this as proof that Pakistan, clearly a very difficult ally for America mm-hmm. over the years, now respects America in a new way.
Mm.
Is there anything to that?
It's hard to say, but it certainly does raise the hopes of a possible warming in a long fraught relationship, that of the United States and Pakistan. And you know, if the United States wants to get anything done in Afghanistan, it has to have a good working relationship with Pakistan. So I think this latest development with the couple is at least gives us some hope.
And clearly, Pakistan over the years was accused of supporting
yes.
people like the
Haqqani
Network. So Donald Trump perhaps can claim a diplomatic win by his toughness as...
He does make everything all about him, but in this case, maybe, you know, this is something he can put in the win column.
Very briefly, Richard, in the 30 seconds we have, in Canada, has this been a big story? I mean, she's a Canadian woman. Were people a bit startled by this?
Actually, he is.
He's Canadian.
He's
husband,
Canadian.
Yeah,
it's been a big story, but because also he was linked, he was married for a year with the sister of Amarka there, who spent so many years at Guantanamo for terrorist activities. And then he was freed because they had nothing against him. The Canadian government paid millions of dollars to Amarka. So, yes, we're following this story closely, but we're very happy that they've been freed. And indeed, it's been for President Trump a win in this column, yes.
Well, that's all the time we have. And thank you so much to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Richard Latendresse, White House correspondent for the French-Canadian television network TVA. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.